All right, we are now ready. I am now ready for the first case of this morning, Board of Education against Michael R. and Diane R. on behalf of Lindsay. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Nick Gorga. I represent the appellant, Lindsay R. This case comes to you on appeal from a decision by the Northern District of Illinois District Court granting summary judgment in favor of Appellee 211 and dismissing the complaint against Appellee Illinois State Board of Education. Your Honors, this case is about the hostility of a school district to educating a child with a disability.
But Mr. Gorga, isn't this case, as it reaches this court, really about whether the district court gave the right kind of review, shall we say, to the result of the administrative hearings, insofar as it deals with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act? I recognize you have a different argument about ADA and rehabilitation, but if we could focus on IDEA first. It seems to me there are standards of review that we need to bear in mind as we look at the results of the administrative hearing.
You're correct, Your Honor, that only the ADA and Rehabilitation Act claims actually require some sort of hostility towards the child. The IDEA claims, though, I believe, are colored in this case by the hostility that the district expressed to Lindsay, a child with a disability, and I think it explains a lot of the reasons for what they did. To address your question, Your Honor, about the standard of review here, we're accepting the findings of fact by the district court, as the district court did in its deference to the administrative hearing officer. What we're arguing here, Your Honor, is that under those findings of fact that Judge Kennelly held, that the law mandates only one decision in this case, and that's that Lindsay's rights were violated under the IDEA in three main ways. First, by the District 211's predetermination of Lindsay's placement out of Conan High School, her home school, into a special needs setting months before the actual IEP meeting in contravention of the IDEA. The other way in which District 211 violated the laws to protect children with disabilities is by, as the district court found, refusing to provide Lindsay with the transition services she needed to succeed in life outside of Conant High School. The third way under the IDEA in which the appellees violated the law is by withholding from Lindsay the supplemental aids and services she needed to succeed at Conant, as she had in the past. I'd like to first start with the procedural violations at issue in this case.
Because what I would like you to explain, I know your briefs have discussed this, is how one is to draw the line between a district's preparations for meetings at which the parents will attend, at which the experts will attend, at which everybody will be present, and why the label predetermination is appropriate here, because it seems to me it is quite appropriate for the district to come up with a tentative recommendation. So when the principal says we're going to recommend that she go into a different kind of placement, I don't know that that means he's predetermined so much as it means that's where he is now. He's giving fair notice. There's more discussion to come.
Your Honor, we don't disagree that tentative recommendations of placement are something that a district's entitled to make before coming into an IEP meeting, or that they're not entitled to prepare for a meeting. As the Sixth Circuit in Deal held in its reasoning, lots of times, or most of the time, there's not an explicit expression of predetermination, and you have to look at the implications of the actions. Here we feel that there are three undisputed facts that the district court found that show that the line between attentive recommendation and predetermination was crossed here. And as I mentioned, there's often not an explicit admission of predetermination, but we think the actions by the district come about as close as you possibly can to reaching that standard and definitely cross the line. First, in the August 2003 IEP meeting, District 211 officials walked out of the IEP meeting, left the parents sitting there, went into a private room, and drafted an addendum. The addendum that stated that absent what they believed to be the legal strictures of the settlement agreement with the parents, they would continue to recommend that Lindsay's placement be changed.
But, you know, I've read that addendum, and the addendum looked to me like a statement by the staff of what their view was. It wasn't an ultimatum. It wasn't even a recommendation, really. It was saying, we know that we have this settlement agreement, but our evaluation as of this time is that she needs a separate placement. What's the difference between that addendum and the reports that any special ed teacher is going to write every night, you know, for purposes of transmitting them to the parents?
I believe the difference, Your Honor, is that in this addendum, the District 211 as a whole, speaking as one voice, said that absent this settlement agreement, absent the requirement that the panel disagree, we would come into this meeting no matter what you say, parents. We would come into
but
this meeting as a matter.
Where's that phrase in the addendum?
I mean, were it not for the settlement agreement, as a matter of conscience, public school personnel would continue to recommend an appropriate public or private self-contained setting.
Right, and so where's the added thing, no matter what else you say? I mean, suppose the parents had come in and said, you know what, we have good news. There has been a great new medication that helps children with this syndrome, or there has been a breakthrough in an assistive device that didn't used to be available but now is. I mean, I don't see where that addendum communicates a closed mind of future developments.
But you're right, Your Honor, that it doesn't explicitly say that. But I think in your example there of coming in with evidence that something had changed, in this case, in the August meeting, as the district court found, the expert panel, two of the three expert panel members, found that Lindsay had succeeded in the spring, that Lindsay had benefited from her time at Conan in the spring. And the third panel member eventually was opposed to that, but eventually agreed, and Lindsay was returned. Lindsay met 33 of her 35 goals, I believe is the number, that were set out for her in the spring. So the parents did come in with great news. They came in with great news that Lindsay was doing great. And the district still said they still felt the need to walk out of this meeting and draft an addendum that said we'll continue to recommend that Lindsay's placement be changed. And I think that the later events, Your Honor, shed some more light on that and show while it wasn't explicit in this addendum, that
the
addendum bears on.
Don't you think they're entitled to have an opinion at that point?
They're certainly entitled to an opinion, Your Honor, and we believe though.
Well, that's just their statement of their opinion, isn't it?
Well, but when taken in light of the two subsequent events, Your Honor, I think it's more than a statement of opinion. The fact that only weeks later it was confirmed at the meeting between the parents and the school superintendent, the school director of special education, that they, after only Lindsay only being in school for a few weeks in the fall, would, again, continue to recommend at the upcoming meeting that Lindsay's placement be changed. And second point is that at that meeting, on November 5th, 2003, District 211 walked into that meeting and at the same time sent, as the district court found, sent its attorneys to the courthouse ready to file suit if Lindsay's parents didn't agree to the change in placement. And we agree, Your Honor, with the district court that there was a lot of dialogue at the meeting, that Lindsay's parents were there and able to speak. But the fact that attorneys were at the courthouse ready to file suit, which they did the same day that District 211 walked in and did exactly what it had foretold it would do at the August 2003 meeting, at the October 2003 meeting, it walked in and it said, we recommend that Lindsay's placement be changed. And as the district court found, changed Lindsay's placement to a special needs setting. And then that very day called its attorneys and said, file the lawsuit to bar the schoolhouse doors to this child, to keep her out of school so she doesn't even step back in foot in the school this next day. We believe that
you are assuming, I guess, that the fact that you've got lawyers ready to file is a resource the school district was going to take advantage of no matter what. I mean, I guess what I'm confused by is the testimony from the various school authorities indicates that they were going to use the lawyers if agreement wasn't reached. And I guess the other thing I just want your comment on is I wonder in what way, if at all, do you think the school could take into account from her spring experience how much time she was spending in the mainstream classroom versus how much time she was spending in the other facility they had for her.
Your Honor, to address your first point, I believe the decision was made. I agree that District 211 is entitled to enforce their rights by coming into court if they feel they need to, and that the settlement agreement provides that. I just want to comment on one point, is that the disagreement that's referenced in the settlement agreement was a disagreement between the panel members. The disagreement between the parents and the school district was always there, as shown by the addendum and the meeting with Dr. Cates. It was only waiting for the green light of a panel disagreement, which came very close to happening in August of 2003 and then happened in November of 2003, waiting for that green light to file. And to your second point, Your Honor, I think that bears on the least restrictive environment issue more than on the procedural issue, and I'm happy to address that now if you'd like.
Are we happy to move on to that? Okay.
If you have more questions, Your Honor, on the procedural aspect, I'm happy
to answer
them.
No, I think on the procedural, we certainly know your position with respect to the predetermination, and that's your principal procedural argument, right?
That
they weren't meaningful hearings.
That's essentially our argument, Your Honor, is that when Lindsay's parents walked into that November meeting, the decision had already been made, and their involvement was just after-the-fact involvement.
Right. Okay, well, why don't we move on to the substance then, because there are a number of questions about that, including, I suppose, the nature of the special needs setting that the school district was proposing for, which you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, it's a huge record, but it looked to me as though this is a facility in a different high school in the district that also has a special needs area or something like that?
Appellees can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe that Lake Park High School is not in the same district as 211.
No, but I may understand that. But is Lake Park High School a high school where children without special needs also go?
Yes, correct, Your Honor.
That's what I was trying to get at. So there are possibilities of fine-tuning the degree to which there's mainstreaming with a population that's not special needs children, even at Lake Park High School.
Correct, Your Honor. Conant High School does not have a program that allows for what's called reverse mainstreaming, for a program that provides for children like Lindsay with multiple or special disabilities. So Lindsay would have to be educated. If that were the route to take, Lindsay would have to be educated in a separate setting, such as Lake Park High School, if there were space available for her, which I believe was a point of contention.
Right. So, but if she were at Lake Park, I thought the part of the plan at Lake Park involved maybe it's called reverse mainstreaming. I mean, there's a lot of lingo in this area, but having her in with the general population of students, but to a lesser degree than what the parents were advocating for at Conant. Is that right?
My understanding, Your Honor, of the differences in the placement would be that at Lake Park, Lindsay would be in an insular classroom with kids only with multiple disabilities and severe disabilities, and children from the regular education environment would come in and interact with Lindsay, and that Lindsay might also be allowed to, which is the reverse mainstream aspect.
Thinking have lunch or, you know, I don't know whether and beyond that,
which
programs.
Which also, Your Honor, going out and having lunch or interacting in non-academic settings is something that Lindsay could have at Conant High School as well. Lindsay, especially in the spring, was afforded many opportunities to interact with children in a non-academic setting, as well as the benefits that come with being able to participate with non-disabled children in the academic setting as well.
Wasn't there testimony from her teachers, though, at Conant, that even during the spring they didn't think she was getting, I'll put it strictly and say, academic benefit? Perhaps she was getting social benefits from being in the mainstream classroom, but that they didn't think she was really getting academic benefit?
I believe the testimony from the teachers that the IHO found was varied on that as the level of educational benefit. What I think is important, especially in this case, is that her panel members, who are the experts in this area, who evaluated and spoke with those teachers, did find that Lindsay got a quote-unquote benefit in the spring from her time there, and felt that based on that benefit, she could return to Conant with a doubled course load in the fall. Your Honor, I'm into my rebuttal time, and I'd like to reserve the rest if Your Honors have no other questions.
That's fine. Thank you. We will hear, I guess, from Mr. Takeff.
May it please the Court, Counsel. Neil Takeff on behalf of District 211. In this case, the independent hearing officer, or IHO, who likened this case to Beth B. with injuries, had an opportunity to hear all of the evidence, assess credibility, and make detailed factual findings. We respectfully submit that summary judgment was appropriately granted in this case by the district court.
I would like you to start with a point we didn't get to with Mr. Gorga, and that is the transition services omission in this plan. It seems to me you were trying to do some backing and filling in your brief here, but the plan doesn't really address transition at all.
Well, JB versus Killingly, which is a district court decision from Connecticut that was cited by both parties, indicates that transitional planning services can be special education. And the decisional case law also indicates that the definition of special education may be broad, depending on the student's unique needs. The parents' argument that the student's IEP failed to have a transition form inappropriately exalts form over content.
But is that right? Because if you know that you're focusing on transition, you might change the mixture of parts of a particular student's plan. You might do a lot of things. And so even though I accept at the end of the day maybe some things wouldn't change too, when you've never sat down and engaged in the intellectual exercise that the statute mandates from age 14 onward, it'd be like saying, you know, trust us, we thought about the environment, so we didn't bother to create an environmental impact statement. I mean, sometimes just writing it down on paper and saying, yes, we know we're thinking about this right now, has a substantive effect.
Well, I think that the record does show that in the August 2003 IEP, that there was a statement that said transitional plans will be implemented through the student's IEP goals and objectives, which at that time were focused on functional life skills as well as controlling the behaviors. And I think the record also shows that there was a constant fine-tuning of her plan in response to different behaviors and in response to implementations in her behavior plan that didn't seem to be working. So I think that when you have a student who simply is not able to learn independent skills, such as feeding herself or opening doors or participating in a assisted employment opportunity, given the behaviors that the district was seeing, the student simply would not be able to obtain any benefit from those type of skills if the people that were working with her were continually being subjected to hits and headbutts, if the student's vocalizations...
I mean, I understand. Look, you've outlined her problems, which, you know, her advocates indicate may have come from frustration from not having enough assistance. But I guess my concern is, you know, if you didn't sit down and really think about in the IEP setting with the right kind of interaction in a hearing, you know, now the time has come, you know, people grow and she's older now than she was at the time the district court had this case. The process looks to how do you transition a person, even people with the greatest of all imaginable disabilities. You still have to find some way that you can do the best you can for those individuals. And it's just one thing for appellate lawyers or for us sitting here as judges or anybody else to imagine how this all fits together. It's quite another thing for the process envisioned by the IDEA to create a plan.
I mean, was it your position that she had so many problems that she couldn't transition? That's the impression I get from reading your brief.
Certainly the transitional planning had to focus on getting the behaviors under control. And I think if you look at the two IEPs in question, the August 2002 IEP and the August 2003 IEP, the IEP documents themselves indicate that that exact procedure or practice of kind of thinking this through and deciding what transitional services are appropriate happened. In the August 2002 IEP, there was a report by Dr. Leventhal, his team, which he was a member of the expert panel. In his report, which was discussed at the IEP, it recommended that the students' behaviors be brought under control before transitional planning can occur. It certainly was discussed at the IEP meeting. There was an exercise that was done by the school, but the conclusion was that until the behaviors were to get under control, no further transitional planning would be of any educational benefit or opportunity. In the August 2003 IEP, there was an indication stated in the transitional planning unit, an explicit statement, that they had considered what types of transitional planning would be appropriate for this student and her unique individual needs. And what the IEP team came to, the conclusion was that the goals and objectives of getting those behaviors under control and focusing on life skills is exactly the skills that she would need to bridge the gap from school to post-school opportunities.
So your position isn't that the statute allows you to postpone transitional planning when you think that might be a good idea, but instead is that de facto the two merge in her case, that you did it and it was actually not any different?
If you look,
I don't see in the statute any discretion to omit that step.
There is nothing in the statute that explicitly states you can defer a transition plan. However, I think if there is, and this court has recognized that content does trump form under this statute. In the decisional case law of District 65 versus Michael M., this court recognized that not all procedural violations necessarily result in a denial of FAPE, a free appropriate public education, and by doing so recognized that content trumps form. And if you look at the four corners of those IEP documents, the appropriate transitional services were in place for the student.
Before it's time for you to sit down, I would like your comment on these lawyers. I have this image of a starting block at a track meet, these lawyers who are poised to rush off to court after the November IEP meeting to make sure that the result, that, or whatever, to make sure that the court was going to give the school district the flexibility it needed to do what it wanted to do.
Well, I mean, certainly one has to understand the history involved in this case, and it's in the history of injuries, and some of them very severe and requiring surgery. But what's the fundamental point in discussing the attorneys filing the motion is that the IEP team was insulated from that decision. Every single member of that IEP team who testified at the hearing indicated they had no idea that there was any plan to go to the courthouse. They indicated they were surprised at the decision. This was an administrative decision, not an IEP decision. It's also significant and indicates that there was no predetermination by the fact that the attorney who was at that courthouse had multiple motions to file. And that
opponents say that wasn't in the record. How do we know this is the case?
It actually is in the record. It's at volume 23, page 8041, in which the attorney, there was a discussion with the hearing officer and the two attorneys at the administrative level. And the attorney for the district made a proffer. And in that proffer, he did indicate that he had multiple motions to file because, quite frankly, nobody knew what the results of that IEP meeting were going to be.
Okay.
The central issue in this case is whether the district's proposed placement educates Lindsay in the least restrictive environment.
Well, I mean, I suppose the question, the third question that I know exists in this case is whether on this record the district explored as much in the way of accommodations to her needs as it should have. There's all this discussion about the vest that didn't fit right and other things, whether the district, in a sense, gave up on her too soon.
Well, what is required is that reasonable efforts are made to include the student in the regular education class. If the parents' theory that reasonable efforts were not made in this case, then there would never be an opportunity for a student to ever secure more supportive services outside the mainstream setting, whether that was desired by the parent or the district, because the argument could be always made, well, you tried one full special education teacher inclusion specialist and one full-time one-to-one aide and a part-time one-to-one aide, but you didn't try two full-time aides. When you look at the services that are provided to this student, some of which I listed, and in addition, an expert panel of three members who analyzed data, made modifications, and made recommendations for her inclusion and for those supplemental aids and services, the OT therapy, the PT therapy, the weekly team meetings, and the fact that there was a dedicated administrator at District 211 to, at all times, monitor the situation, it's clear that reasonable efforts were made, and we ask that you affirm Judge Canale's decision.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Legner?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Brett Legner. I'm an assistant Illinois Attorney General, and I represent the Illinois State Board of Education in this matter. Your Honors, in addition to the reasons to affirm the district court's judgment set forth by District 211, there's an additional reason to affirm the judgment with regard to the State Board of Education, and that is a lack of Article III standing on the part of the defendants in their cross-complaint against this specific cross-defendant.
Mr. Legner, could I ask you just as a point of information, ISBE gets involved with this because it monitors, right, particular
Correct.
Districts. Are these state funds that the districts are spending? I mean, why are you monitoring?
There are state funds that are being used by the districts. We're monitoring pursuant to requirement under the IDEA that the state receives state funds and then those funds go to the various districts. And as a result, the state board's monitoring requirement is implicated.
And does ISBE ever decide to cut or reduce funds or in other ways to intervene in districts that are not, in its view, complying with IDEA?
On this record, that's not clear. The State Board definitely could do that.
It has
as
the power.
Part of its monitoring. It has the power. It has the power to reallocate. The state has the power to reallocate funds, you know, amongst the districts as necessary.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, what I'm getting to then is if ISBE had been monitoring District 211 and had thought that it was failing in its obligations under the statute, in particular with respect to Lindsay, it could have done something, right?
That's correct.
So I'm not sure that there's such a large gap between ISBE's monitoring and what happened to Lindsay as you may be suggesting.
Well, I think that the gap occurs because there's no indication that there is simply no allegation that the ISBE did not monitor this case or that it somehow incorrectly monitored the case. The ISBE can monitor a case and agree with what the district has done, even though the district might ultimately be wrong, but that's not because of a failure of monitoring.
I thought there was every allegation that ISBE had incorrectly assessed the situation. Isn't that why you're in the case?
The allegations in the complaint against the ISBE are that the OSER's OSEP found as a general matter the ISBE did not have an adequate statewide monitoring system to address systemic issues of noncompliance within districts. There's no indication that the ISBA did not monitor adequately this particular case. And that is the gap. That is the problem. Their reliance on this general systemic notion, it certainly doesn't mean that the ISB never monitors or mismonitors in every case.
But, taking it from a different, maybe looking at the other end of the telescope, if just a person with concerns about educating children with special needs had brought a lawsuit against ISBE, and had said, we don't think you're monitoring right, you'd be here saying no standing. Who are they? I mean, they're taxpayers or they're just bystanders, and that's not enough to show a direct interest in the case. Now, here we have before us people who are the ultimate beneficiaries of the statute that you are supposedly monitoring under, and you're saying they don't have standing either, even though they surely look a lot better than the random taxpayer or interested bystander.
Well, yeah, and the point the reason we're saying there's no standing here is not because they suffered no injury that's cognizable. You know, the point is that there's no link. You know, when there's a challenge to a government action or inaction by a party that is not the subject of the government action or inaction, in other words, they're challenging the ISPE's monitoring of District 211, the ISPE's action or inaction regarding District 211, the party must show, must allege facts, must allege enough to show that District 211's conduct was the result of the ISPE's action or inaction. And that's not here. That's the problem. It's not that there's no possibility of standing. You know, if there were allegations that, in this case, the ISPE failed to adequately monitor this educational placement decision.
You think that's the way we need to read this complaint under Rule 8? I mean, it sounds to me like you're asking for a rather detailed sort of fact pleading. And if ISPE does have the authority to reallocate funds around the state, if ISPE has the authority to tell a particular district in the state, we don't think you are handling your responsibilities under this statute well, maybe that would redress the injury that the plaintiffs allege Lindsay suffered.
Well, you know, I think sort of two points in response to that, Your Honor. First, you know, it is possible that it's redressable through here, but that's separate from the causation issue that we're really focusing here. And it's true that the pleading requirements aren't heavy at this point in the proceedings, but there still must be sufficient specificity to show this jurisdictional issue of standing. And the complaint specifically refers to the OSER's OSEP finding of general problems of monitoring generally throughout the state concerning systemic problems. But there's no allegation, no basic vague, you know, allegation that the ISPE failed to monitor or did something in this case that led District 211 to violate the provisions of the IDEA. And that's really the heart of the matter. It's similar to prisoners saying, Illinois prisoners saying, there's reports that say Illinois prisons are bad, they're overcrowded, conditions are not good. That does not mean that every prisoner can establish an Eighth Amendment claim. They still have to have some sort of more specific, you know, and certainly the burden isn't very high on a pleading motion under Rule 8. There's no doubt about that, but there still must be something more specific that would bring it within causation and show Article 3 standing in this case. And for those reasons, Your Honors, the ISPE asks that this court affirm the judgment of the district court and find that the defendants did not have Article 3 standing to bring their complaint against the ISPE. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. How much time did Mr. Gorga reserve? Okay, 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to first address the transition services arguments made by counsel for District 211 here. District 211's counsel stated that because Lindsay wasn't able, under the estimation of her IEP team, to meet her functional goals, she wasn't entitled to a transition plan. That's just wrong under the IDEA.
They're not quite saying she's not entitled. Like, I understood them to be saying, even though, you know, perhaps as Polonius put it, brevity is the soul of wit, this very brief statement about transition, which was that the same thing she's going to need for the long run is what we're doing now, namely these life skills, was enough.
Your Honor, that sentence there talks about goals. It talks about functional goals, hygiene, self-care. What if Lindsay never gets to the point where she can, because of her her physical disabilities to the point where she can take care of herself functionally and her hygiene, her self-care. So what? She's still entitled to a plan for how she succeeds in life after. She will have an aide, someone to help her out for the rest of her life. That's undisputed. But that doesn't mean that she can't do what a transition services plan is geared towards helping her be able to do, which is be a member of the community, be a greeter at Walmart, hand out towels at a gym, serve at the church, be part. She runs, skis, rides horseback, as the district court found, to be part of a recreational sports team. These are the type of things that transitional service plans are geared towards, is how is this girl, not what goals is she going to meet while she's within the confines of the school, but when she steps out of school, what happens to her? You know, is she
What has she been doing? She was 19 at the time the district court proceedings took place?
She turned 17 in 2003 when the November IEP came out. She turned 17 in October. So even one quick point on that, Your Honor, is that even if the statement of the August 2003 IEP meeting somehow constituted a transition services plan, she was already almost 17 years old at that point, and is required to be in there at 14. Even if that were true, it wouldn't be enough. But
You're seeking, with respect to that, what exactly you want the school district to start over again with a transition plan, come up with a transition plan? What's the relief you want on that in particular?
The relief we would like on that, Your Honor, is until Lindsay turns 21, the state is statutorily required to continue to provide her with services, and that includes a transition plan and transition services. You know, at this point, due to the district's actions, the ability for Lindsay to go back into a school like Conan High School, that ship has essentially sailed. You know, she'll never graduate on time, so there's no point in her going back there. So the parents are no longer seeking for her to be reinstituted in Conan High School. What they would like, though, is there are schools and private programs that provide explicitly for transition services, a transition plan. District 211's counsel stated that Lindsay couldn't possibly need a job. I believe it was a job coach or something along those lines. Of course she does. She can hold a job. She can be a greeter at Walmart. She can do the things that people with severe disabilities do. So Lindsay is asking that she have her parents be able to propose a transition services plan funded by the district that, until she turns 21, provides her with the transition services she needs, so that as soon as she hits 21, she hits the ground running as a functional member of the community, a contributing member of society, which she absolutely can do. In addition, as long as we're on that topic, Your Honor, there would also be an element of compensatory education that Lindsay would ask for, which would be for the time she's lost here, additional adult services or adult education after she ages out of Conan's jurisdiction.
One more year, basically.
She's at this point, Your Honor.
Until she turns 21. Right.
She just turned. I believe she is turning 19 in October of this, or 20 in October of this year. I'm sorry.
If it was 17 in 2003.
You're exactly right, Your Honor.
That's why none of us are physicists, right?
So she turns 20. So if she, my understanding, and I could be wrong on this, but my understanding though is that if she begins a school year at the age of 21. She would be entitled to finish out that year, so I think it would be 2 years.
Okay.
So she would have 2 years of transition planning, and then we would ask for compensatory education to continue for 2 or 3 years after that for the time she's missed as she's been sitting at home over these last few years. Your Honor, I see my time is up. Unless you have any more questions, I thank you for your time.
What's your position under the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act? You think this matter's got to be sent back to explore those issues?
Correct, Your Honor. We believe that summary judgment on the ADA and rehabilitation.
They're the same issues, though, aren't they, that have already been explored here at considerable depth?
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor. I believe that there are, as we showed in our opening brief, there are acts that's, first of all, it's a different standard under the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act, and the IDEA was specifically amended in 1986 to make clear that it was no bar. As long as the litigant first explored the administrative process and exhausted their administrative remedies, which has been done here, even if they're seeking the same relief, they can bring a suit under this. We believe, as shown in our opening brief and as recognized by Judge Cannelli, that there are many disputed material facts in this issue, and ruled on, judged under a Rule 56 standard, we believe that Lindsay would be entitled to a trial on the merits on this. If Your Honors have no further questions, I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you to all parties here. We will take this case under advisement.